Do you want to know who's really responsible for Donald Trump becoming president? It's Alan Funt. Yes. He's the man who invented reality TV, kind of by bugging people.
There was something kind of pervy and boundary crossing that isn't easy to sentimentalize.
I'm Mark Fennell, and that is just one exceptionally weird individual who changed the course of history, but trust me, there are more, and you'll hear about them. Just search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The last day of Lisa Lynn's life, it seems, was mostly uneventful. It was a Monday. She dropped off her sons at daycare and went shopping. She bumped into a friend and told them she'd bought clothes for an upcoming date. She picked up the boys and went home. At dinner time, she walked across the road with a meal she'd cooked for her neighbours, Bronwyn and Robert. Bronwyn phoned after dinner, around 8:30, to thank her for the lovely food. As Bronwyn remembers it, Lisa seemed fine. Tired, like any mum with two young kids, but fine. That same night, on the other side of Mount Macedon, Lisa's friend Jane had some friends over. As they were sitting down for dinner, the phone rang. But they were just about to eat, so Jane let it go through to the answering machine. It was Lisa.
Our guest can remember her calling us and saying, "I feel unsafe."
Jane was often a shoulder for Lisa to lean on. She's the friend who'd slept on Lisa's couch a couple of times when Lisa was scared. Jane says Lisa would reach out often, worried about abusive calls from Greg. So Jane suspected tonight would just be more of the same.
The phone calls were so regular by this stage saying, "I feel really unsafe," that he's calling. It was always at night. I said, I can't do anything. And I think, naturally I was just spent.
So this time, she didn't answer the call. Jane knew if Lisa wanted to chat, it'd take a while. So she told her guests she'd call Lisa back tomorrow.
I said, "This is just, this is getting really hard." It would have been the same. It was not a high alert distress, but she was distressed. If it had have been any different, I would have called her for sure.
To this day, it plays on Jane's mind.
I know that I'm not responsible for someone else's life, but I do wonder, imagine if I had have picked up that phone.
Lisa Lynn was just 34 years old when she died. Her life ended just as her friends thought things were finally looking up for her. But how did she die? That's what everyone in the small community wanted to know. How? And why? I'm Rachel Brown and this is Huntsman, the latest season of Unravel. For Lisa's friends, the phone calls on Monday night don't seem out of the ordinary. And on Tuesday morning, life on Zigzag Road continues as normal. Terry Hollingworth, who lives down the street, wakes in the early cold before her kids are up. She throws on her clothes, puts her big wolfhound on its lead, and they head out for their regular morning walk along Zigzag Road.
It was just the dog and me had set off at our usual time, and it was a brisk walk. And I always kept the dog on the lead because we'd often startle kangaroos and she would have been off. So that morning it was no different, except it was very cold.
It's always the same route, past her picket fence, around the block and back home again. It's been 25 years since that cold winter morning, and memories may be less clear after so long. But here's how Terry remembers what happens next. As she approaches Lisa's bluestone house, a couple emerge from the garden, sort of waving their arms, looking distressed.
I could see something on the ground.
This couple on their morning walk were strangers to Terry, but they lived nearby. They'd noticed a figure lying in the front yard.
And the lady said to me, I don't know if she's dead. And I went up and I could see I was Lisa. She looked asleep. And she looked like she'd laid down in the grass and gone to sleep. In a sort of awkward way.
Lisa is wearing thin clothing, too flimsy for the freezing morning air. She has no pulse.
I knew she was dead, but I couldn't move past the fact that she was freezing because she had bare feet and there'd been a really cold night. I said, I think she's dead.
The couple have called emergency services. Between Lisa and the house, there's a glass that looks like it's been dropped, laying on its side, and a slice of lemon. The car is in the carport. The driver's side door is open. Lisa's sons, just 1 and 2 years old, are home. The couple who found Lisa try to get inside. The front door's locked. Why are the kids inside alone when Lisa is locked outside? The wife covers Lisa with a red blanket. The husband gets into the house through the side French windows.
I could hear the children crying.
Inside the house, family photo albums are open and scattered on the lounge room floor. And a Nick Cave song is playing again and again and again on a loop. I've heard from two different sources that this song was called Nobody's Baby Now. As the song drones on, the lyrics float through the house. I was her cruel-hearted man. And though I've tried to lay her ghost down, well, she's moving through me, even now. I don't know why, and I don't know how. But she's nobody's baby now. At some point, paramedics and police arrive. Meanwhile, Terry soothes the children.
They were both crying and the eldest one was saying, Mummy, Mummy, Mummy. And I said, oh, Mummy's just outside. I'm Terry, the lady with the big dog. And took them around the side of the garden because I didn't want them to see their mother. And took them across the front grass in front of the house, away from Lisa.
Terry sees the neighbour's lights are on, so she drops the boys over there. Then she returns to Lisa and stands vigil. She can't even bear to look at her, laying under the red blanket.
It was getting lighter, and the bird noises were more apparent. I know that I was shaking quite badly and I was really focused on, I was looking for birds as a distraction. I didn't talk to her. I don't think I've said anything out loud.
Once someone arrives to formally identify Lisa, Terry goes to leave and she walks past Lisa one last time.
I felt really bad about leaving her so cold and I remember saying, her feet, she's so cold, she needs to have socks on. And her feet were blue. Yeah, that brings me to my knees.
The morning Lisa Lynn was found, Detective Brendan Hickman was on shift.
I was in the car with another detective. It was sort of crispy, clear, cold morning.
He worked at a local police station in the region, a small station.
Your normal thefts and theft of motor cars, burglaries, attending house burglaries, checking for fingerprints and things like that.
But this morning would be more serious.
We got a call from someone from the uniform branch. She was deceased in the front yard of the house and they asked me to come and have a look.
This local officer knew that Brendan used to be based with the homicide squad and that sort of experience could be useful.
He wanted to make sure that it was sort of cleared of outside influence.
So basically, whether someone else could have been involved in Lisa's death.
I think because I'd had the experience at homicide, I was sort of the conduit between, you know, where do we go next?
This wouldn't be Brendan's case to take on. He was just lending his expertise.
So I agreed to go up and have a look at the scene. She was on the in the front garden, I think in the lawn area. I think she was lying on her side. So we checked the body. There's no sign of any outside interference or violence. We go in and check inside.
Brendan enters the house. He carefully scans the rooms.
So you look around at, you know, ceiling level, then you look around at sort of eye level, then you look around at floor level, and you'd be looking for something that might be a stool knocked over or a cushion on the ground or, you know. You would imagine that if they were involved in a struggle, there would be something out of place. There was nothing out of place. It looked like there had been no one there but one person. There was a fair bit of alcohol consumed. There was a lemon sliced up on a cutting board on the table. There was a bottle of gin or vodka, one of those, partly consumed. There was some evidence of some medication. There was a record playing on a record machine on repeat. It set the scene of someone who was depressed and had been drinking, mixed with antidepressant tablets, puts this song on repeat, which was a Nick Cave song, I think. It was not the happiest of songs. And because I remember saying to my colleague, oh, listen to that one, over and over and over.
It looks to him like no one else has been at the scene.
The scenario that we thought most likely was that she'd had too much to drink and had gone out to get some fresh air, maybe sat down on the grass or collapsed, and then was exposed to the cold night in not wearing many clothes. That was the conclusion I came to.
There's another reason the local police asked Brendan to look at the scene. 7 months earlier, when Lisa got an intervention order against Greg Lynn, Brendan says he helped take her statement. So he knew about the history of abuse in their relationship. But he says he had to focus on the evidence in front of him.
The mind's like an umbrella. It doesn't work unless it's fully open. That's a detective thing. You always go with an open mind. So I was aware of that there'd been a domestic situation, but you'd be looking for physical evidence that there was another person involved.
So the fact you have knowledge of the intervention order, that doesn't like set off a little alarm in your
head? It sets off an alarm bell, but it doesn't set off, you can't find things that aren't there.
There was nothing out of place.
There was just no indication of any outside involvement. It wasn't sealed off or dealt with as a crime scene as such because it wasn't established that a crime was committed. You would need to have conclusive evidence that she'd been murdered, and there wasn't.
The scene was cleared, as they say, pending any new information.
Normal procedure. There'll be an autopsy. If anything comes back from that, that's when we'll step in.
And that was that. News of Lisa's death spread like wildfire around Mount Macedon. There was disbelief and confusion as frantic calls were made between Lisa's neighbours and friends.
I was in shock. I think I said to the police, "Where is Lisa?" And they said, "She's been taken to Melbourne." And yeah, I just knew I had to go and see her.
Lisa's body was with the coroner, but Jane was allowed to say goodbye.
I could see Lisa, I'll never forget. She just looked as beautiful as she always did, and I can remember thinking, you didn't want to go. You've still got things to do.
Lisa's family held a memorial service. There was no coffin. It had been months before the coroner would release Lisa's body, so this memorial service was it for now.
Everyone was there, everyone was sort of in shock.
Pat was there, the pilot who checked on Lisa at Zigzag Road when she was scared. Lisa's neighbours, Bronwyn and Robert, were there. Terry, who owns the Wolfhound. A large contingent of flight attendants. John Payne, who ran the choir. Hundreds of Lisa's family, friends, neighbours and colleagues packed into the church.
Thank you.
There was a massive turnout. I think people were still incredulous that she was dead. It was very emotional.
Pat tells me he never cries at anything, but that day, he was a mess.
They played Two Little Boys, which was, you know, I think a favourite song of Lisa's that she used to play to the kids. I think everyone was just crying and just, you know, it just makes me just fucking even thinking about it just makes me upset and angry. And there was just a whole lot of disbelief that it actually came to this.
As part of their investigation, police looked into what Greg Lynn had been up to the night Lisa died. Brendan Hickman was called on again by the team in charge of the case, this time to talk to Greg.
I've ended up taking a statement from Greg Lynn at the Sunbury Police Station to sort of, you know, clear him of his, you know, whereabouts and alibi, so to speak.
It wasn't an interrogation. Greg wasn't a suspect. It was just a chat, given his connection to Lisa.
Just to test his version, you know, as to whether we thought he might have been involved or not.
Greg's signature isn't on the statement typed up by police, but it's not clear why. In any case, according to the unsigned statement, Greg Lynn gave a detailed account of his movements. He said his partner was working interstate that night, so he decided to take himself out for dinner. Throughout the night, he visited four bars in the Melbourne suburbs of Collingwood and Fitzroy, where he drank by himself and read a book. He says he finished up around 1 a.m. and caught a cab home. Greg was able to provide receipts from that night for cigarettes and for a bank withdrawal of $40 for the cab ride home. He even remembered the taxi driver's name, Moses, apparently. Greg told police once the cab dropped him home, he went straight to bed. The next day, he reported for work in the morning. Greg said he hadn't seen Lisa since negotiations over their split broke down, more than a month before her death. Because Brendan wasn't in charge of this case, it wasn't his job to cross-check Greg's alibi, but he assumes one of his colleagues did. We've asked Victoria Police what else was done to verify Greg Lynn's movements that night, but it says it can't comment while matters involving him are still active. Brendan says nothing about Greg's alibi stuck out to him. Nothing felt off.
I'm pretty sure he just ticked all the boxes. He sort of knew all the answers. He could account for his movements and his whereabouts, and he was clear and precise about his answers. And
do you remember his demeanour?
Certainly wasn't nervous, no. Didn't seem upset either. He was, I'd say, a bit neutral to it maybe, you know. He didn't show emotion either way. He never gave any physical sign away that he was telling lies or wasn't being truthful.
According to the unsigned statement, Greg Lynn told police, quote, "I would like to add that I am extremely sorry regarding the circumstances of Lisa's death. Whilst I admit that relations between us had deteriorated dramatically and that there had been an intervention order that I have contravened and that I did make certain threats against her, I had absolutely nothing to do with her death."
I can't say how he felt, what he felt, but he expressed compassion and accounted for his own whereabouts. There was no indication from what he said that he was involved.
In May 2000, almost 7 months after Lisa's death, the state coroner handed down his finding. This finding was made, as they say, in chambers, like most coronial findings are. So there was no public inquest and no witnesses called. The coroner found Lisa Lynn died from combined alcohol and drug toxicity. Lisa had a blood alcohol level of 0.21. It's hard to say for sure, but for someone like Lisa, that might take roughly half a bottle of vodka, drunk over a few hours. Not enough to kill on its own. But the coroner also said she had high levels of drugs prescribed for depression in her system. 2 months earlier, Lisa had seen a counsellor and had been prescribed antidepressants. Both alcohol and the other drugs in her system cause sedation, so taken together, they can be dangerous and potentially fatal. The coroner made a point of saying that Lisa and Greg's relationship appeared to be quite abusive. But he said police didn't find anything suspicious, nor any signs anyone else was involved in Lisa's death. He said Lisa hadn't left a note, nor any other indications of her intentions. He found, quote, "It is unclear whether she intended to take her own life." Lisa's friends were left dumbfounded.
I just knew it wasn't suicide. It didn't even cross my mind.
I don't believe that she committed suicide at all.
All of Lisa's friends who I spoke to told me the same thing. It couldn't be suicide. But after someone takes their own life, people who loved them find it hard to believe. They often say there were no warning signs. Even still, Lisa's childhood friend, Jo Matthews, says Lisa's sons were her universe.
I do not believe, I cannot believe under any circumstances that she took her own life, that she intended. And I don't believe that she accidentally did it either. She would never have left those boys. Never, ever, ever, ever. And I will never accept that she did this voluntarily. Those boys were her sun when it came up in the morning and the moon when it set at night. Her life revolved around them, and that's what she was looking forward to.
Heather Quenneville, Lisa's flight attendant buddy and godmother to her youngest son, said the same.
I think if Lisa had planned a suicide, I think she would have made sure that her boys were looked after. She didn't trust anyone else with the boys.
Heather felt that for a mother who was hypervigilant, it didn't make sense.
I mean, if you're in a house by yourself with two young boys, there's no way that you're going to knock yourself out. There's no way that you would put yourself into a position where you wouldn't wake up if they needed you.
All of Lisa's friends who I spoke to echoed this, that Lisa would not have left her kids. And she wouldn't have deliberately downed a cocktail of pills and alcohol while her kids were asleep in the house. It's possible that she didn't take a huge number of pills, but the alcohol just reacted badly with the medication in her system, increasing its toxicity. But even then, Lisa's friends said she rarely drank.
She actually doesn't drink.
She was barely a drinker at all.
That's massive quantities of an alcohol. And for a person that doesn't drink, that doesn't make sense.
But there's something missing here. We do know of episodes when Lisa might have done things that her friends say were out of character. There was the time when Greg decided Lisa had drunk too much, and he tied her up and hosed her down to teach her a lesson. 6 years earlier, there were two incidents back in Tasmania at low points in the marriage when Lisa landed herself in hospital. Once by quickly drinking cooking alcohol, after which she stopped breathing, and the other by eating pest poison. When Greg was interviewed by police after Lisa's death, he brought up these incidents. He also brought up another incident, way back at the start of their marriage, when he claimed he was worried she might have taken too many sleeping tablets. He said he shook Lisa awake, but she told him she was fine. So could Lisa's death have been another moment where she'd impulsively taken or drunk something and gone too far? Her childhood friend, Jo Matthews, says these examples are old and irrelevant, uncharacteristic chapters from a past lifetime. That by 1999, Lisa's life was very different. She was a devoted mum, with two young sons depending on her. A month before Lisa's death, negotiations over the separation had broken down. Greg told Lisa he'd leave the country and she'd never see him again. But Jo Matthews says Lisa seemed to be looking to the future.
For all intents and purposes, things were fine. Greg was long gone by this stage. She knew Greg was gone. She was together. She was with it.
She wasn't just with it. Lisa was making plans, a Halloween party, a Melbourne Cup picnic, a medical appointment, and she'd even bought clothes for an upcoming date. In the days after Lisa died, Joe called the house on Zigzag Road to talk to Lisa's mum, hoping to get some answers.
I called the house, and to my utter horrified shock, Greg picked up the phone. Some autopilot inside of me operated, and I said to him, "Did you do it, Greg?" And he said, "Do what?" And I said, "Did you kill Lisa?" And he said something like, "Don't be ridiculous," or "No, I didn't," or but in a very controlled, calm, I can't actually believe that I said that.
Joe was not the only one with suspicions. After years of watching Lisa and Greg's relationship deteriorate, all of her friends that I spoke to wondered whether, somehow, Greg Lynn might have been involved in Lisa's death. Still clear in their mind was the time a few years earlier when Greg bound her wrists with tape, hosed her down, and left her out in the cold. Later, Greg and Lisa battled through an acrimonious separation. And domestic violence experts say the time between separation and divorce is the most dangerous time for people escaping abusive relationships. It's the time they're most likely to be killed or seriously injured. And Joe and Lisa's family say that around this time, Lisa was seeking legal advice and preparing divorce paperwork. Lisa's family was worried about her safety. Because before all this, Lisa told friends that Greg had threatened to kill her numerous times throughout their relationship. And according to her friends, when he made these threats, he'd sometimes add that he could arrange to have her killed in a way that wouldn't be traced back to him. We'd like to be able to hear Greg Lynn's response to this, but we've been unable to put questions to him. More about that next episode. For Joe, there was still a lot of unanswered questions.
Why did she go outside and walk across a gravel driveway in bare feet late at night on a really cold night, dressed only in her pyjamas? Did she attempt to go for help? Did she have a realisation that she was incapable of driving the car in the condition that she was in? Why did she get out of the car? Why did she head down the driveway? If this was a suicide, why was she doing that? It just, there are questions, many, many unanswered questions.
Even the little details raised questions for Lisa's mates. Details that might have seemed innocuous to detectives seemed out of place to those who knew Lisa best. Like the cut-up lemon for the drink.
It was just too perfect. If you were that distressed, you wouldn't be cutting up lemon to put in your drink. That's purely aesthetic. You'd probably miss that detail.
As for the music, some of Lisa's friends found it hard to believe Lisa would put Nick Cave on repeat. She was usually into classical music or Enya.
She wasn't really into deep, dark songs, you know. I mean, she was a Christian. She used to love playing a piano, but she wasn't a person who would wallow. So I can't see her changing her whole personality and just deciding then and there that, you know, she'd had enough and she was going to drink herself into oblivion and leave the boys. Absolute bullshit.
Of course, a garnish and music aren't evidence an investigation can hinge on. And people who are depressed, anxious, suicidal, they don't always act rationally. But these small things added to the conviction of those close to Lisa that her death required close investigation. Lisa's friends just wanted police to know this wasn't the Lisa they knew. When some of them tried to come forward with that sort of information, they felt like no one was listening. Jo says she tried numerous times to share her concerns with police but felt dismissed.
I can admit that that might not have looked suspicious at first glance, but to not ask those questions and to not be willing to listen to the people who wanted to tell you about those things, why?
As I said earlier, we've asked Victoria Police about this investigation, but it declined to answer our specific questions. A spokesperson said it wouldn't be appropriate to comment while matters involving Greg Lynn are still active. Brendan Hickman, that detective who investigated the scene, he wasn't running the case, so it wasn't up to him who police took statements from or how her death was investigated. But I thought I'd put some of the concerns people had about the scene of Lisa's death to him, to see what he made of them.
Could someone manufacture that scene to make it seem
yep,
normal?
Absolutely.
How?
By setting up the cutting the lemons. Could someone have come in and manufactured that setup in the kitchen? Yes, but she had been drinking. The facts of the scene have been corroborated by the coroner's report.
Lisa's friends had raised the possibility with me that Lisa might have been under duress or pressure. So I put that to Brendan.
I don't know how that holds up. Where's the evidence?
Have you ever been in a scenario where someone, be it through a threat or fear, has imbibed, but not wanting to themselves, but has imbibed drugs and alcohol?
Not that I recall. No, not that I recall. But again, back to how do you prove that? If someone's been forced to drink or forced to swallow pills, there might be some bruises or hand marks on the face, you know, neck. There was nothing. I still think the circumstances of her death match the evidence that was at the scene. You know, it's not impossible that there was another person involved, but there's just no evidence of it. We can only go on what we saw. If the evidence isn't there, well, then you can't go down that path. And I think any victim's family at the time, you know, think, oh, the police should have done more. That's a natural reaction.
He says the relevant and appropriate steps were taken at the time.
I just have to keep coming back to the scene, and the scene was not indicative of an extra person being involved in it.
I spoke to so many of Lisa's friends for this project, and the thing that struck me over and over was just how much her friends loved her, how important she was to so many people, how much she'd touched their lives. And it also struck me 25 years later how heartbroken they still are that they couldn't have done more to save her from a toxic relationship. So it's not surprising that her friends suspect Greg might have somehow been involved in her death, given his abuse while she was alive. And it seems even police think there might be more to investigate now. In the last few years, since Greg's arrest over the missing campus case, police have interviewed most of the people in this podcast, with a view to putting a new brief of evidence to the coroner. If the coroner decides there's enough fresh information, they may announce an inquest into Lisa's death. And if that happens, maybe some more of the remaining questions around Lisa's death will finally be answered.
Sugar?
One for me, please.
Terry Hollingworth, the woman with the wolfhound who watched over Lisa's body. She wasn't friends with Lisa. They'd only really met once. But after Lisa died, Lisa's mum gave Terry a present to thank her for being there for the family.
She actually gave me this.
Terry turns and lifts a lead crystal piece from a table behind her couch. At times as we're chatting, as sunlight hits the decanter, it either seems to sit inside it or be refracted out in sparkles.
Oh, wow, this is Lisa's. Beautiful.
Yeah.
It's a ship's decanter. Ironically, it's flat bottom for stability of all the things. And I used to think that it was there as a reminder that I hadn't done a good enough job in picking what was going on.
Back in 1999, Lisa's mum wrote a statement for the coroner that blamed her daughter's death on how Greg treated her. It reads, "As far as I'm concerned, Greg is responsible for my daughter's death by mental torture inflicted by him. I know that she was living in absolute fear of Greg. I accept from what the police have informed me regarding the circumstances in which she died, that she was alone on the night. Greg was not there. However, her actions were a culmination of the fear and terror that she lived under. There is evidence of this contained in a journal and diary which Lisa kept." Since this statement, however, things have changed. You'll hear more about this in later episodes, but for now, it's enough to say that Lisa's mum supports the idea of a further investigation into her daughter's death, and she doesn't believe that Lisa would have taken her own life. Terry Hollingworth says, even if Greg Lynn wasn't there that night, the pressure Lisa lived under may have contributed to her death.
So in your mind, the blame could fall on him without him even having been there?
Yeah. Mm. Oh, absolutely. If he rang her constantly, it's that sort of malignant presence. That constant reminder is a form of coercion that is actually saying clearly, I'm still in control of this situation. You cannot escape me no matter what you think you're doing. I'm here. I will always be here. And for many people, that is a hell that is unbearable. That lurking threat would break anybody. And you add enough alcohol, and had she passed out in the house, she probably would have been alive today. But because she passed out outside, she didn't stand a chance.
It's late afternoon. The light shifts. Sunshine fills the decanter. It glows golden. Terry cups her hand around its side.
I keep it there to remind me that there's always more to every story.
Within a week of Lisa's death, Greg Lynn moved back into Zigzag Road with his two sons. As Christmas rolled around, 2 months after Lisa's death, Lisa's friends started to receive ominous cards in the mail. Robert and Bronwyn got one. They were Lisa's lawyer neighbours who came to her aid when Greg broke in. They remember opening a festive yellow card with the right side filled with writing.
There's a Christmas card from Greg saying that hope we were happy, and this is the bit I really remember, saying that we were responsible for Lisa's death because we had told her not to guarantee his loan.
Earlier in the year, Robert and Bronwyn had advised Lisa against going guarantor on a bank loan for Greg. He'd asked after they'd separated, and he was furious when Lisa refused.
I thought it was really weird sending a Christmas card like that.
He was clearly pushing blame for Lisa's death away from himself and onto others, because I understand there was more than one of these cards sent around.
Jane says her husband got a card too that seemed to be mocking him about his dad's recent suicide.
It said, "Cheer up. This hasn't been such a bad year after all."
And Lisa's pilot mate, Pat, thinks a number of pilots got some pretty nasty Christmas wishes.
Went to work one day and there was a Christmas card in my mailbox from Greg. It was just like a cheap Woolworths pack of 10 cards. And I opened it and said, so it was something like, "Don't worry, your life is bad. Mine is fantastic. And it's just going to keep getting better."
Pat had had enough.
I saw red immediately and walked into the chief pilot's office and threw it on the table and said, "This is bullshit. This can't go on."
According to Pat, it was enough to get Greg stood down for a while. We've tried to verify this with his manager from the time, but he declined to speak to us.
He was returned to work, but he was taken off flying for a short period of time.
I asked to see these cards, but none of the people we spoke to had kept them. One told me it didn't seem like Victoria Police was investigating Lisa's death, so the card went in the bin. After that Christmas, life returned to its normal rhythms. It was busy for Greg. He had a baby with his new girlfriend. But that relationship broke down as well. And then he moved to Qatar with his two sons to fly for Qatar Airways. He'd meet a new wife over there, another Australian flight attendant, and have a child with her as well. Back at home, Lisa's friends and family were left with their grief. Greg Lynn had disappeared from their lives. For 20 years, they barely heard anything about him. Until November 2021.
This torched campsite was the last sign of secret lovers Russell Hill and Carol Clay, whose disappearance became a major mystery.
Here we have two people that have literally vanished into the wilderness.
Greg Lynn, the man charged with murdering the campers and dumping their bodies in remote bushland, will now face a jury in Victoria's highest court.
This season of Unravel is intended to be listened to as a whole, so if you haven't heard all the episodes, you shouldn't draw any conclusions, because you haven't heard all sides of this story. If you need help with any of the issues raised in this podcast, please check the show notes for phone numbers you can call. If you'd like to get in touch with me or my team about this story, please email us on unraveltruecrime@abc.net.au. This season of Unravel is hosted and reported by me, Rachel Brown. We've been making this story on Gadigal, Wurundjeri and Wadawurrung land. This story was developed in collaboration with the ABC's Regional Investigations Team under editor Edwina Farley. Research and production by Charlotte King, Andy Burns and Ayla Darling. Our supervising producer is Yasmin Parry. Sound design and additional music by Hamish Camilleri. Theme and additional music by Martin Peralta and Ashley Cadell. And our executive producer is Tim Roxburgh.
Inside the most extraordinary criminal trials in Australia, the Case of podcast is your eyes and ears in the courtroom. From the triple murder trial of country mum Erin Patterson, who fought charges she poisoned her relatives with death cap mushrooms.
There didn't seem to be any motive.
I never imagined that we'd see her on the stand.
To a celebrity crocodile wrangler charged with a cover-up of evidence from a chopper crash.
Everybody wanted to know what had happened.
And also the mystery about this mobile phone.
Search the Case of, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.